Michigan. He's also a research professor at the Center for Political Studies. That's part of the Institute for Social Research. He has spent some time. He took a leave recently from his job there at Michigan and spent some time working on information and security technology policy at the White House at the Office of Science and Technology Policy. He's also taught at University of Pennsylvania, where he directed the Information and Society Program of the Annenberg Public Policy Center. And he's taught at Harvard and Yale and was one of the founding faculty of the MIT Media Lab. We're pleased to have him here on the program. As we talk, as always, questions from people who are listening are welcome, too. All you need to do to be part of the conversation is to pick up the telephone and call us. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455 here. So at any point you want to be involved in the conversation, you can do that. The only thing we ask of callers is people just are brief so that we can get in as many callers as possible. But anyone's welcome to join us. Thanks very much for being with us, stopping by.
Thank you, David.
I was looking at a book that you co-authored, a book titled Common Knowledge, News and the Construction of Political Meaning, that came out in 1992. And I was really struck by something here in you and your authors have in the preface. And the line that I caught my eye was this. Despite a 200-year-old tradition of public participation, an intense and virtually uninterrupted barrage of video, audio, and print information, and I guess now we would add the internet to that, a volume of information on local, national, and world events, one finds a conspicuously large number of citizens with only marginal interest in and information about public affairs. So that was 1992, and I think it's fair to say that statement still holds, that the barrage is even greater than it was, and does indeed now include a lot of online news sources. And it seems to be the case that there is still a significant number of people that feel disconnected from politics, don't seem to have the level of interest in news that at least those of us who work in the news media think perhaps they should have. And the question is, in the face of all of the information that's now available to people, why is that the case? Why is it that the demand somehow doesn't rise to meet the supply?
Well, I like to use a metaphor to compare the public domain in terms of politics and the ins and outs of Congress and the local legislature with people who follow sports. And you know many people who follow baseball or football or soccer or hockey, and you'll talk to them and they'll know all the names of the players and who's been fighting whom. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense to them. They have a complete structure. But take somebody to a football game who's never seen it before and they say, I don't know, something's floating around in there, and they all jump on each other in a pig pile, and I sort of don't understand it. I sort of get the general idea that they're trying to go that way, that is, towards that goal. And if you start to think, I think, sympathetically about people who grew up in a household that may say, well, if you're going to vote, vote Democratic, but other than that, there's not much to politics. And so if they get around to voting, they may vote as their parents had told them, but they're not attending to the fine points of policy. They can't name the different players. They're not quite sure who's in charge of Congress. They sort of know the name of the president and maybe the vice president, and they have a general sense of things are going well or not. Research for the last 50 years calls that domain the nature of the times. Mm-hmm. So they have a sense, well, there's this war over there somewhere. It's kind of far away, and there's some oil, and they're sort of Arab, and that's about it. And that's not an unreasonable way to deal with hockey and soccer. The presumption that you bring and many people bring is this is our collective public sphere. You should be paying attention to the lives of young men and women that are being sent over there. You should be more attentive. But they have chosen to focus on other things.
Well, what that might suggest, though, and I think that that's one of the arguments that you and your co-authors make in this book, is that there is something missing, some disconnect, something wrong with the relationship between the people who are consumers of news and the news media and what it is the news media choose to cover and how they cover it. And it's not that people are completely disinterested, but it seems, and not surprising, that the thing that interests people most is what affects them personally. personally their families, their daily life. And something that happens at the other side of the world, it's difficult for people to see what that has to do with their daily life. Now, maybe in a particular case like the war in Iraq, if they know someone who is serving, someone in their family, someone in their town, then that's going to make a difference to them. And so in that sense, that it might mean something that it wouldn't otherwise. But with so many issues, particularly international ones, but sometimes even national ones, people, the question they have, well, what's this got to do with me? And it sounds as if the news media is not doing a very good job answering that question, what has this got to do with me?
The book that you referred to did an extensive study of how people related to news stories, the exact same story being covered as it would naturally be covered in a magazine, a daily newspaper, or on television. And as you know from your experience in journalism, there's a tradition of the, quote, inverted pyramid, a structure for how you write a news story so that the primary facts are brought to the attention of the reader first in case the reader doesn't read to the end of the story. And in radio, and particularly in television news, there's a narrative arc. A story is told. And if you think about it, television might be, and broadcast, and perhaps even the internet eventually, successful in drawing people into the public sphere because it is a storytelling medium. And if you think about the evolution of the human brain after millions of years in the hunting and gathering society, it's only been in the last 5 or 10,000 years that we've had writing. So how would a generation communicate with its children and share the wisdom of its experience? The answer is telling stories, perhaps even epic stories about heroes who fought with dragons. And so I think, and there's evidence in psychology and in the physiology of the brain, that organizing things as a story, first this happens and then this happens and there's this tension and then it's resolved, the narrative arc, is a way to engage the human mind, because that's how before we had writing and print and text and all the new technologies. And as we get to telling stories in the news media and not saying the high prestige way of doing it is sounding like the New York Times and using an inverted pyramid and highly abstract way of describing the news, and using the terms about politicians where the journalists have been following this politician for the last 10 years, and it's hard for the journalists to imagine that these other folks have been paying attention to other things and don't know who the majority leader is in Congress.
Mm-hmm. So part of it is that the news media, the reporters, particularly people who run certain beats, are so absorbed in the story, as sometimes the criticism is made, that maybe they're too close to it. They're too close to the sources. They're too close to the story. They know it so well that they have a difficult time telling that story to somebody else who doesn't know it.
In this particular study, we interviewed each of the reporters and columnists whose material we had chosen to use for our study on 5 different topics. And we asked them, who did you talk to about your story after it was written, to see if they sort of got it or reacted to it or liked it? And the answer was always their spouse, perhaps their next-door neighbor, and certainly their peers and their editors, but never readers or viewers. And one of the nice things about the internet, with the fact that very often now in journalism, the email address of a reporter is included right at the bottom of a story, reporters will increasingly, and I hope the public will respond, so that this disjuncture between the kind of highfalutin notion of abstracted news, which has guided journalism in journalism schools and has been the norm in the newsroom, will start to loosen up. And the challenge of the bloggers will have a positive effect in convincing our culture that there's more than one way to tell a news story.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's the case that the news media has, when reporters and news organizations ask themselves this question, what is news, what should we be reporting, they have a certain set of ideas that they apply to answering that question. And I think that in a lot of news organizations, they have thought about the news as, and the news that people should have is kind of like eating their vegetables. You know, they have this idea that there's news that's good for you, that you really ought to have, and that is the news that they try to report. And it is not always the case that seems to be the news that people want or that they really relate to. And I wonder how you think about, in a sense, you know, perhaps this is a question that should go to the editors and the reporters, but how you think about making that, weighing up those two things. What, on the other hand, you think as a journalist you think is important and that people ought to know about, and then those things that actually people want to know about, they're not always going to be the same things.
In that book and in further research, I've been focusing on, well, will the internet really make a difference in the overall level of public information, awareness, and interest? And right now, the answer is not, at least not yet, and perhaps it will. And I think the most important part of the new technologies, if you think about it, a newspaper is by definition a one-way product. Unless somebody sends a letter to the editor, which is 1/100 of 1% of the readers, you're not going to know how the public is reacting to what you're writing. In television and radio, by definition of the limited use of the spectrum, it's all broadcast one way, and occasionally there's a letter or a phone call coming back. But with an internet-based communications medium, you can have as many reactors, listeners, as are interested to respond. The nature of blogging and internet discussion groups, I think, will generate a very rich basis for us to start thinking about how you would frame an issue so its relevance for their daily life. This is the presumption we have, that those five headlines in the New York Times are relevant for the public if they only understood it, if they only like we do. And this is the problem, I think, of an unfortunate elitism in the media and in journalism training.
Now, I do want to talk about the internet. Let me ask you one other question. I think that people in the news business are concerned, maybe also people in communications and in public policy, are concerned about where it is that people get their news. And there seems to be concern that a lot of people are getting their news from television, and that the content of television news is not as strong. I'm sure this people in the newspaper business feel that it's not as strong as the content in print media, particularly in traditional newspapers. And certainly if you look at the amount of news that's in any day's New York Times, for example, and compare that with the amount of news that you will get in one of the evening newscasts on one of the commercial over-the-air broadcast networks, or for that matter, if you look at what happens on CNN or Fox or any place like that, or even All Things Considered for that matter, there's an awful lot more news in the newspaper than there are in those other sources. And I think that there are people who are concerned that somehow what people get, if all they're doing is getting their news from television, they're not getting a very good understanding of things because of the way television news operates. What can you say about how it is that the sources of news over time has changed, that is where people get the news? And do you think that it matters very much where people get their news from?
It is often noted that if you took the entire television network evening news, it's a 30-minute newscast, but because of commercials, it's only 22 and a half minutes of actual news content, and typed it out, it would fill 3/4 of the front page of the New York Times. And everybody goes, well, take a look at that. Of course, how is it possible that you could cover stories in sufficient depth on television if, in fact, you've only got 3/4 of the front page of the New York Times? What isn't noted, and what should be, is that virtually nobody reads every word on the front page of the New York Times, and a very large portion of newspaper readers, not the New York Times in particular, will pick up their local news, throw the front page away, go directly to the sports page and the comics, and that's the extent of their reading of the newspaper. And as you may know, fewer and fewer people are reading newspapers. There's a very strong economic downward trend, which is going to challenge the newspapers. We did research on the very first movement with the Pew Center surveys of those who were online and getting news online in addition to newspapers. And we've gradually gone up so now that those that are online, 50% get at least some of their news-like information, including sports information online. And initially, the people that got news online showed a higher interest because they were the early adopters, higher level of information. And as that grows to be a typical way, you'd sort of, you know, just look online for weather and sports and maybe some headlines just to see what's going on, it will look more and more like your average viewer, and you'll see less and less difference between those who say, well, I get a fair portion of my news online rather than offline. So the answer to your question is no, even with some shifting. And they're not sort of dropping the newspaper entirely and picking up the internet completely. These are gradual trends. The level of interest in abstract public affairs was always rather low. In early research, journalists routinely use as the primary yardstick for measuring politics the liberal-conservative continuum. And when you ask people to describe and define liberal and conservative, the number of the American population that can do so is a stunning 2.5%. If you have a somewhat liberal, well, they sort of get the general idea of liberal and conservative as a yardstick for measuring political beliefs, you get 12.5%. And those numbers haven't changed dramatically. And it's hard to imagine a reporter who doesn't have the liberal-conservative yardstick built deeply in himself or herself as a way of trying to understand how things are organized. And once you get that disjuncture in numbers of how folks who have lives that are organized around their families and their jobs and their extended families and not around the abstractions of politics, do you get to think that, well, maybe it'll be a good idea to shake things up, move away from the broadcast norm and the newspaper norm and the magazine norm and start exploring new ways to get the ideas out.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Russell Newman. He's professor of media technology at University of Michigan. And we're talking a little bit about social and political impact of media, both the older ones and the newer ones. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The internet. One basic question, one way to start out is to ask this question. When the internet was younger than it is now, people were making some pretty sweeping predictions about what its impact would be and how it would change things, particularly how it would influence what people know and how they got their news and how well informed they were and how politically active they were. And the idea was that it would boost people's political engagement because it would increase their access to information and more sources of information, that it would make it more possible for people to network, to form virtual communities, to have dialogue with one another, and they wouldn't have to be people that lived next to each other or even lived in the same town, that it really cut down boundaries between people. And people said, now with the internet, everything has changed. Everything is going to be different. And I suppose that often happens when new technologies come along. People say, well, this changes everything. And in fact, it changes some things, but it never seems to be quite as dramatic, at least not at the beginning. So what can one say about that question that the internet, well, in what ways has it changed things?
David, you ask difficult questions. I heard about four or five different things I could respond to.
I'm sorry. It's one of my weaknesses.
Let me pick a few as I heard your question. Certainly I agree with you that the pundits like to say, oh, it's all going to change. I think part of that's just wishful thinking. Pundits wish that people were more like themselves and saw the world more like themselves. One question is, will it be easier for individuals who care about some issue to find each other and organize? Mm-hmm. And the answer is yes, and it makes a difference. Jesse Ventura made a very dramatic example of that when his highly motivated and outsider supporters would get themselves together and he'd drive in his car or bus to some new location and there'd be 50 or 100 people there waiting for him as a result of them interneting among their friends and using also instant messaging and other related digital technologies and wireless technologies to get organized. So your capacity to find like-minded people is literally increased by that. Just as the Amazon and eBay sorts of marketing techniques mean you get to look at the whole market at once, not just your little local market. That's important. So clearly that's an area where it makes a difference. But in order for it to make a difference, people have to care about an issue initially. And that's the premise. And, you know, 2.5% is still many millions of Americans, and they can make a big noise, and they can show up at a rally, and they can contribute money, and moveon.org. Lots of these are examples where a few people can make a difference and do. The other issue is, how will the internet change the political dialogue? And this wasn't directly, but I think indirectly included in your statement about, well, what's going on. And the individual who has sort of popularized this question is at the University of Chicago Law School, and his name is Cass Sunstein. And his prediction is that people don't want news they disagree with. People don't want to hear the other side of the story. So when the newspaper and television mixed it all up and you sort of had to listen to what the other guy said, we were going to become increasingly polarized, increasingly fragmented. And he picked up on my colleague Nicholas Negroponte's notion of the Daily Mia newspaper that only has the stories that you agree with and just simply excludes news from areas of the world you don't care about. Who cares what the Arabs are doing? No Arab news. I'm going to fill it, which, of course, is technically possible. And research some of our graduate students have just completed at the University of Michigan. We said, well, good, an interesting, important hypothesis. The data just simply don't support it. Turns out that if you care greatly about abortion or about a particular nominee to the Supreme Court, you want to know what the other side is saying so you can deal with those issues. So although people do like to hear information supporting their point of view, they don't exclude the other side because they want to, for those who are motivated, those that are interested, they care what the other guys think.
That's, I guess that's encouraging to me because I would have thought Cass Sunstein was right. I guess that's based on my limited experience that sometimes I do think people really only want to hear other people whose opinions match with theirs. And now, particularly that we have the internet, it seems that it is easy because there are some in the blogosphere, and then there are so many, there are organizations, individuals that have a particular point of view that they are advocating. It would be easy to spend all of your time reading people that you agree with if that was what you wanted to do. And I guess it's encouraging that that seems not to be the case, that in fact, that doesn't necessarily mean that people will change their mind by reading another set of opinions, but at least they are reading other sets of opinions.
Well, David, you may have friends that are exceptions to the rule, but other than that, the general pattern is quite clear.
We have a caller here to bring in the conversation. Let's do that. Line one in Urbana.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Hi.
What a great subject. And a part of this is, I think when you touched on, or David touched on, the locality and how people feel, does that issue matter to me? You know, like Arabs, who cares? And also, then from the local to the regional to the national to the international, you sort of find people who are, very few people are international. Most people are local, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But and also, I'm really concerned more about the critical thinking skills taught to students. And through that, you would be, you know, look at something and go, well, there's got to be another point of view. So you maybe look through the internet, which I agree with you 100% that the internet is a fundamental change in the way people will get information, and they can share information with other people too. But also, I was going to point out that I think that, I forgot my thought, but I just want to say it's a really fascinating subject, and I'm glad you're talking about it because not enough of this is talked about or said or spoken of in media, even sort of every, you know, like I read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal every day, and I mean they're just polemical. I mean it's amazing that you know the editorial pages are like, you know, like it's just astonishing how different people can think and on one subject, and I'm probably an exception, but I just want to let you know. But thanks a lot.
All right. Well, yeah. Thanks. You want to react to anything?
Well,
that the
caller said? The caller had raised one particular point that you'd left out of your 5-point question, which is, do the new media reinforce globalization? And in that case, the answer I think is quite strongly yes. In order to appreciate that, you need to think about the artifact, the historically limited artifact of the fact that the broadcast spectrum is licensed within a nation state. And that along the Canadian border, the Canadians will hear American stations and vice versa. But for the most part, what you get in broadcast was controlled by the nation state regulated or national broadcasters. And 80% of the world up until the late 1980s, all broadcasting was run by the government, not by commercial broadcasters. America was the exception to that. Newspapers tended to be local, and very seldom were newspapers from other nations easily available. And on the internet, there is no difference between you get your news from Germany just as fast as you get your news from Champagne.
Hmm. Let me ask a question. I'll try to ask just one. We were talking before about the over time, the percentage of people who are passionately absorbed by the news, who really want to understand, work hard at being informed, and that has probably always been a relatively small percentage of the American people. If you look at those people who now are heavy users of the internet and who use it that way, is it still a small percentage? And would those be the same people? Are we talking about the same people, and they would have been the same people before the internet, who were using whatever sources there were, and that their numbers haven't particularly increased? They've just embraced a new way of getting the information.
The answer to your question is yes, they're pretty much the same people. If you look for a survey and try to figure out, well, who are the people that pay a lot of attention, like our caller, and read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, they tend to be highly educated. The best predictor of news attentiveness is number of years of education, and college and graduate school increase the likelihood that you'd be attentive and read multiple newspapers. But it's you follow politics like a fan of a football team follows the team. You've got your favorites, and I would just speculate that our caller disagrees with some of the editorials he reads in the Wall Street Journals, but enjoys finding out how these people, representing a kind of conservative and very pro-business orientation, and the Wall Street Journal is delightfully provocative in the way it defends its point of view, especially on the editorial page, thankfully not as strongly on the news pages. And that's the wonderful diversity that I'm personally hopeful we'll see more of, because a bland, homogenized news source is, I think, less likely to engage a larger part of the public than one that's willing to take a stand.
Hmm. One of the things in early on when, and again, when the internet was growing and we saw an increasing number of people using it, there was concern voiced about access. And the term that I'm sure people are familiar with is the digital divide. The idea that if you look at who's using the internet, that it tends to be higher income people. And that may indeed also have higher levels of education. But here, income was a significant thing, because you've got to have the computer and you've got to be able to subscribe to the internet service provider, and not everybody could afford to do that. What can you say now about the digital divide? Does it still exist? Has it closed up some?
When I was working in the White House, one of the assignments we got was to keep track of the data on the digital divide, and the hope was that it will have more or less disappeared. And the work we did with the Department of Education indicated that virtually all of American schools, and these are schools where you think, well, those are the schools that used to have dirt floors in very rural areas of the South or perhaps the West, and through federal support, among other things, the difference had been made so that the poorer schools were connected. It's still true that if you go to a kind of a suburban school in Menlo Park, California, the parents of these kids are writing the programs and building the computers. So when the volunteers come in, they've got the fanciest, latest gear and the best software. But in the schools, people were online. And you're quite right. At the very early stages of the penetration of the internet, the better educated and the wealthier were more likely to have an internet connection. And the digital divide was something important to look at. But as soon as you get to the 50s, 60s, and 70%, these differences decline. I think the most exciting difference that started out in the early days was the fact that boys were more likely than girls to get online, and that gender divide has completely disappeared. Young women are as likely to jump online and Google something as young men, and that's a wonderful development, I think. And you may have noted that in Tunis, at the international gathering of world leaders to deal with how the digital divide, which is still quite dramatic internationally, where African countries literally have tiny fractions of 1% of penetration of the internet compared to the urban nations where in Asia and Europe, large percentages, 80%, 70%, have access to the internet at home and in many cases broadband. My colleague Nicholas Negroponte said, I've got a new invention that you've got to look at. It's not a computer. It's a $100 computer. And you don't have to plug it in. It's got a battery that you recharge. It's got this kind of cute little plastic crank on it. And he was showing Kofi Annan the this new model and say, let's take advantage of our capacity to lower the price, not just to increase the fancy-dancy this and that. And that was just a classic of Nicholas's instincts, and I think it's a wonderful instinct. So bringing the price down to the computer, bringing the wireless access, which is a lot less expensive than a wire or fiber to your local residence, can make a big difference and even further diminish what remains of the digital divide.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Russell Newman, he's professor of media technology at University of Michigan. We're talking about media and its social political impact. We've been talking here a little bit about the Internet. We have a couple of callers in Chicago waiting to talk with us, so we'll do that. Going first to line four. Hello.
Hello, good morning. I noticed something that really disturbed me. I noticed that National Public Radio lately has been carrying the same stories that Christian Science Monitor carried, and usually a couple of days later, and they're usually social interest. The one that stands out is the one that I guess every single news service carried about the gentleman who would start a rural dating dating company online. But there was another incident, and I guess my question is, has the cutback in staff among many news media resulted in the fact that there are fewer reporters doing independent stories, and are we all just listening to the same few stories? Because at the same time that we talk about the profusion of sources that people have, what exactly are they getting? Because so much, especially of mainstream media, seems to be social news, almost popular entertainment news, and not really informing one or that would help one deal with public affairs. And there's also seems to be a lack of analysis. They just throw it out there. Like over the on Friday, they were announcing that, well, Visa's said there was a 14% increase in the use of their credit card, as if to imply that more people were shopping. But it also turns out that Visa is running this game during the holidays where I don't know, maybe 50 people will win $1 million if they've used their Visa card during this period. So, you know, if there had been any type of analysis, someone might have suggested that maybe they're just using a Visa card instead of a MasterCard and there's not this increase in shopping. So I guess my question is, are there fewer stories, and are the stories without any type of analysis, simply information that's thrown out and it's left to the listener or watch or viewer to connect the dots?
I think that's an excellent question our Chicago listener raises. And again, I'm hearing two parts to the question. First is the question about it has a in the field of the study of journalism, it has a sort of a nickname, and that's the term pack journalism, where the notion is journalists read each other's stories all the time, and they either spin it the same way so that editors aren't upset about why they're spinning a story or interpreting a story in one way differently from the others. And as soon as a kind of acute human interest story about a puppy dog or a tragedy where a child is lost in a well, everybody responds to these, and the local story becomes a national story because of its human interest domain. And that's been true for as long as there's been journalism, that journalists, the best read, the best read portion of the citizenry are the journalists who spend much of the day reading each other's stuff and thinking about how they might pick up and interpret that. They're looking always looking for a story that will please an editor. That's in the professional interest of the trade of journalism. I can't respond to whether cutbacks have made any difference. I would suspect not, that these patterns of picking up stories from the wires and following with them, maybe adding a local twist to it, has been part of the there's a lot of space in a newspaper and on radio, and with 24-hour cable channels and the 24-hour demand of online news, that's a lot of room for stories and information, so you'd expect that they would be looking to each other for something new and fresh to put on the air.
You know, I can't accept that because I just don't think that 90 minutes is enough to carry the news, and in all things considered, especially Christian Science Monitor, which you know, has limited resources, I could understand their using it. I can't understand why, all things considered, 2 or 3 days later would carry the same story with no new information, no new twist, and it's just there's so many things that need to be covered just in the national seen alone is you see different things being done. The legislature, the type of laws that are going through Washington right now, and they get no mention, even to give a follow-up perhaps on the scandal with Abramoff and Michael Scanlon. I mean, I can't accept that, they've got to fill this up, because I hear the same stuff over and over and over again. I mean, what struck me about the Katrina coverage was that CNN seemed to be showing the same film clip over and over and over again, and it's like, what day is this? This isn't the same day, because I saw that yesterday, and you're showing it again and again, so what's happened to these people since then? I don't feel that either they have given up trying to fill the hours and they're just showing the same things, or they've chosen not to add the many information that's coming on to them across the world, because there's no reason to have the duplications that we see, especially with public radio, which by nature is alternative and should be showing, trying to be different.
Well, I think the Chicago caller's call for more diversity in interpretation and for more depth of coverage of stories is, an important impulse. And I think if you look online and look at the bloggers, you'll find that they're interpreting things differently. They're looking for something to differentiate themselves from the mainline media. But I think you should be a little bit more sympathetic for the poor editors online and in the wire services who are looking for something that is visually grabbing. And if you get a couple of seconds of some very telling scene from Katrina, they're likely to use that more than once, because it's compelling television and the industry measures the audience size every minute, and that's the bottom line for that industry. I think you got to accept the economic basis of commercial news.
Well, thank you.
All right, let's go to line number one. This is also someone in Chicago. Hello.
Hello. I was just wanted to comment on the ownership of media and how that affects the reporting and the coverage as far as what's being carried. I noticed since ABC was been bought out by Disney, and Disney also owns a lot of other media outlets like ESPN, and here in Chicago they have three or four radio stations, a TV station, and it just seems that there's been on the news more entertainment coverage, and it's gone that way since Disney took over. They have film reviews now, restaurant reviews, and it just seems that this is kind of crowding out the serious news. And I think that probably contributes to the dumbing down of the population as far as politics is concerned. And I'm just wondering if I think it's true of other companies too. Viacom owns CBS, and just seems that the news media has become an arm of the entertainment media, in the sense that these are entertainment companies that own news stations. And I'm just wondering if you draw the same conclusion on that.
Well, that's a frequently discussed issue about ownership and media. There's always a presumption there's some kind of trend, that it used to be that the news media covered the news in depth and seriously and covered the issues, and now they're covering light stuff. But if you think, and we say, well, why don't people write more in the style that would win a Pulitzer Prize? And of course, Pulitzer goes back 150 years to an era of yellow journalism and highly provocative and sob sister stories. The 19th century traditions of journalism are a fascinating case in popular culture and storytelling. And I think it's healthy, and that the public will always say, why don't the news media or the public media carry more serious news? And they'll never carry as much as they should. And the fact that people are concerned is good, and the fact that it hasn't changed much is probably not surprising.
Can I ask another point?
Yeah, sure.
You talk about the Internet, and that does offer other options, but I think in a roundabout way it might even contribute to the dumbing down in the mainline media, because I think a lot of the corporations that own radio stations, TV stations, realize that serious news people are serious about the news actually are turning more to the Internet and alternative media, and I think they're taking that into account and going with lighter stories. Do you think that could possibly be true?
Well, you'd mentioned ABC, and ABC shifted its style of news when a new producer came in the early 1980s, and they basically conducted a series of focus groups and surveys to try to understand what would make people watch ABC, because ABC at that time was trailing badly in the network evening news, and wanted to come up with a concept that would bring them up in the ratings. And that research said shorten the stories. People liked the average, not the news junkie or the serious news reader or listener, liked shorter stories. So they shortened their stories up and their ratings went up. Same thing happened with the research that was done for a full year when Gannett introduced USA Today. And they basically said, well, people don't like to read a story and then follow the jump to another page. It's inconvenient. So they designed a newspaper where the stories would end before you ran out of space on whatever page you were on, to have a no-jump system, which meant, by definition, shorter stories and flashier color and flashier headlines and graphic images. And so the dumbing down is simply a response to market demand, in my view, and the presumption that this must be because that Disney bought ABC is, you know, it's easy to speculate, but the decisions are made in the newsrooms by professional journalists who've evolved in that culture and do what they can to keep as much serious news on the air as they can. And but I think the listeners' concern and, in fact, demand that the newspapers and media ought to be more responsive is a very important issue to be voiced.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. When you look at the way people use the internet, and I'm interested in specifically in this sort of question. If you go to the internet and you're looking for some kind of information, and you don't know specifically some specific site, you don't have a specific site in mind, you go to your search engine, whichever one you use. And apparently most people make their searches pretty broad and general. And people have looked at how it is that people use the information and have found that, in fact, they make their searches pretty general and that they don't go very far down the list. And then it may come up with 100 hits, and that most people are probably going to look at only the first couple.
Maybe 50,000 hits.
Yeah. Well, yes. So many hits.
In one-tenth of a second, yes.
Exactly. And most people are not going to look at those 50,000. They may not even look at 10. They may only look at a couple. So then it becomes very the way that the search engine goes about pulling up those sites, which they list, what order they list them in, is very important. And there is concern that commercial considerations maybe play a role here. And the search engines there's certain things they're giving to people, certain things they're not. Have you looked at that? And indeed, does that shape how much that shapes, how much that ultimately ends up shaping content? I mean, if you will, if people are only going to look at the first few hits that come up.
David, that's an excellent and important question, and you managed to ask it without mentioning Google specifically. Google is the king and queen of the search engines at the moment. It is the king of the high-tech stocks at the moment. And the reason it has the power economically it does is that it satisfies what people want. It has the most sophisticated algorithms, and Bill Gates and his friends at Microsoft have been trying to compete because they know this is going to be a very important steering mechanism to lead people towards some information and not others. And so what Google takes very close attention to is which of the 10 things they throw up in answer to the question of whatever your question you asked. People go to the fifth one, and that's the one they liked the best. That seemed to give them the information they wanted. Then Google moves what came up fifth up to first. So they're literally using what people click on next to improve their capacity to satisfy the demand. Google is very clear about saying these are sponsored answers to your question and not just somebody that we happen to throw on the front page so you'd see him and not tell you about it. So they're trying to balance that out. But there's a very new and very important issue. It did come up, I guess, today in the New York Times, something that's been on a lot of people's mind. Google knows exactly what you've asked, and it keeps records of your interests. And in one particular case that was mentioned in the article this morning, see what happens when you spend too much time reading print. some individual had looked up who has been now accused of a murder, had looked up the name, the words neck and the words snap on Google, and that Google search has now been retrieved from Google's records and is part of the prosecution case against this individual. So one issue that has not yet come up, but one that should and will, is the issue about how these empowering technologies give us access to all kinds of information, but there are big brothers out there that are keeping track of where you're going and why. And I think we need to pay a lot of attention to how that information is used and setting up, what the story today said, let's see a privacy upgrade for Google.
Yeah. We're coming down to the point where maybe have about 5 minutes. And actually, I think that we have another caller here locally, so I want to make sure we want to get them in. Here in Champaign-Urbana, line number one, let's do that. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a chance of some people paying to have their ads pop up on a browser or whatever, but aside from that, what determines what turns up? If you type in some keyword, you often get a long string of things that aren't related, but what determines what pops up? And you mentioned Big Brother. Well, there's books on privacy, and they say basically as long as one uses a phone line, one can be, privacy compromised. Can you comment on that? No need for, like, biometrics yet. You just use the phone line.
Well, since the invention of the telephone network, with a court-sanctioned legal document, local and federal police can tap your lines. And what's been under review for the last 20 years has been an attempt to say that all access providers to the Internet have to be able to do the same thing to a court-ordered inquiry from federal or local officials to tap the information going back and forth across your Internet connection. And that's currently under court and legal review, and there are various technical proposals for how that should be done. And there are various ways that individuals who are concerned about that can protect their communications by encrypting it. So it turns out that in terms of the bottom line of the technology, if you are interested in sustaining your privacy and your communications with others, you can set up very sophisticated encryption techniques that would take officials many months of high-powered computers to try to decode each and every word that was communicated. And so the premise of our caller that if you're going to use the telephone lines, the U.S. mails, your communications can be tracked has been true and will continue to be true. Hmm.
Something that that we don't have very much time to get into, but I know that is an interest of yours, has to do with regulation of telecommunications. And there seem to be two extreme poles in the conversation. One, on one end, people who say it ought to be basically a free market. Let the market rip and it'll take care of itself. And on the other hand, people who say, no, some regulation is necessary, particularly to protect the public interest, whatever we think that is, and perhaps also to rein in a little bit the commercial interests that would do what they could to make as much money as they possibly could. I think that you seem to have argued that there may actually be some mid-ground in that conversation between the two extremes of, say, heavy regulation and no regulation?
I do. And you have correctly predicted my response. You've used wonderful words to describe the two ends of this. One is heavy regulation, which is like large offices full of cubicles of bureaucrats watching how everything is done and making decisions based on their sense of what you ought to do. And the other side, something we might read on the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal, mm-hmm. Let the market rip. And if you let the market rip and Viacom buys up all of the competitors, it's no longer a market, it's a monopoly. So certainly there has to be antitrust and competition regulation that'll protect the marketplace from the dominant carriers, the dominant providers buying everybody else up. And that, I think, ought to be a principal concern for us as we see pressures on these guys reinforce their instinct to say, well, if you can't beat them, buy them.
Yeah. Is it likely that kind of, can you in Washington, D.C., is it really possible to have a medium between those two?
It's hard. In Washington, D.C., the voices you hear are those that are highly motivated, that have paid lobbyists to speak. My experience in Washington was that coming up with a very balanced and nuanced proposal would furrow the brows of my colleagues, and they say, how academic of you to have raised it in that way. Let's get something that we can get the lobbyists behind.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that with our thanks to our guest, Russell Newman. He's professor of media technology at University of Michigan, also spent a little time working in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. He taught at the University of Pennsylvania, where he directed the Information and Society Program of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, and also taught at Harvard and Yale and was one of the founding faculty of the MIT Media Lab. Thanks very much.
David, thank you for having me.
Programming here on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. This show, Focus 580, is also made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Did you know that some urban crows have learned to recognize a fast food logo? They will sweep in on refuse with the logo, and they will pass over plain bags containing the same food. Crows and their relatives in the corvid family are very smart. They're also very social creatures. And coming up today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, you'll hear some stories of crows and humans. Celeste Quinn, the host, will be talking with the authors of a new book from Yale, In the Company of Crows and Ravens. That's in the 1 o'clock hour. The Afternoon Magazine itself gets underway at noon with the usual mix of news and weather and sports and other things. Coming up in the next part of this show, we'll be having our regular monthly program on women's health. Dr. Suzanne Troopin will be here. She's an OBGYN. We'll talk about what's new in her field coming up in a little bit. First, though, we'll break for news, an update on the markets, so please stay tuned.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
It's 10:59 Central. With this market update, I'm Tom Rogers. December wheat is trading at 295.25 at the moment, down 1.75 cents. March is down 3/4 at 311.5. December corn is at 187.75, down 2 cents. The March at 201.5, down 1.25. May corn 210.5, down 3/4. December 238.75, down 0.5. In the beans, January trading at 548.